Hello, I'm Caroline Williams in London.
Hello, I'm Ivan Semenik in Boston.
And this is SciPod, the international science podcast from New Scientist magazine.
This week on the July 7th edition of SciPod, Love Unlimited. What happens when you don't suppress the normal human desire to have multiple partners? Psychologists and biologists explore polyamory.
Wonderwall. How a thin sheet of graphite, one atom thick, is opening doors to a new quantum universe.
Solar system in a can. A new test for hidden dimensions involves launching a working model of the Earth and Sun in miniature.
And from The Last Word, who needs eyebrows? Perhaps anyone who has an emotion that words simply can't convey. SciPod. It's not just a podcast. It's the very essence of happiness. Some say monogamy is the bedrock of human society. Most of us just assume it's the bedroom arrangement that makes the most sense, particularly for child-rearing purposes. But people who practice polyamory present a fascinating challenge to monogamy as a social norm. This week, New Scientist takes a closer look at the biology and psychology that may underlie this alternative lifestyle choice. We reached science writer and journalist Annalee Newitz in San Francisco.
So, Annalee, I guess we should probably start this conversation with some description of what kinds of relationships we're talking about. I think most people have a pretty solid idea of what monogamy is, but polyamory seems like a new idea. Is it a modern configuration that is only something that we see now? I mean, how do you characterize these relationships?
I think people who are in polyamorous relationships tend to characterize them as any kind of relationship that steps outside the boundaries of monogamy and in which all parties are informed. So it's not cheating, it's having an open relationship, usually a faithful kind of relationship with multiple partners. And what really sets it apart from something like polygamy is that there's really no one single structure. So it's not one man with multiple wives. It could be a woman with multiple partners of both genders. It could be a kind of extended family where several people are loosely involved with each other. So it's a lot of the people who practice it say that it's the kind of thing that could really only happen in a culture that's experienced feminism and that's experienced some of the sort of sexual liberations that occurred in the 1960s and 70s.
Now, in your reporting, you had an opportunity to meet with people in these relationships. Were they feeling in their relationships the way anybody would feel in any marriage, or was there something that some tone or attitude that characterized these people as different?
I think in a lot of ways, the people who are polyamorous behave exactly like people in monogamous relationships, which is to say a lot of the same issues come up about living together and keeping the bathroom clean and trying to keep schedules and take care of the kids. I think the main thing that's different is that there are no hard and fast rules for how these kinds of relationships work, except for the fact that everyone has to be open and honest about the kinds of relationships that they're having. And so one polyamorous group that I talked to seemed quite stable, and you know, the people involved, it was five people who were all, some of them were involved with each other and some of them were involved with outside people, but they all lived together. And they were relatively stable from day to day. They had set schedules for who was with whom on what night. And then other people that I talked to, for example, one couple, they had a very strong primary relationship with each other and had a child together, but then each of them had kind of flings on the side.
I guess the thing that would immediately comes to mind is that there are all kinds of stresses on a single monogamous relationship, on a single couple. You know, all couples, you know, have differences of opinion and so on. And it just seems like adding more and more people to that mix would somehow magnify those tensions, in addition to the kinds of jealousies and other cross-group tensions that might arise. So what is keeping these groups stable, or do you think they are stable?
The impression that I've gotten from talking to several different psychologists and psychiatrists who've been studying polyamorous families over time is that actually they are surprisingly stable, and that a lot of polyamorous groups stay together as long as monogamous people stay in marriages. And one of the things that that Meg Barker, who's a UK psychologist, pointed out to me when I was talking to her is that, you know, there are new stresses with a polyamorous relationship, but also it liberates the people involved from some of the stresses of a monogamous relationship. And those stresses are things like having to keep yourself from cheating on your partner, which can be a really huge stress for a lot of people. And the other thing that Barker pointed out was that the advantage of polyamory is that you get away from this notion of one person being perfect for you and having to serve all of your emotional needs, which is very, very difficult. And a lot of monogamous couples, people put pressure on their partners to, you know, enjoy everything with them, like, I want you to not only like baseball, but also Doctor Who, and also long walks in the park. And if you don't like all those things, we can't be perfect mates. And with polyamory, you can have the partner who wants to watch Doctor Who with you. You can have the partner who wants to take long walks with you. And you don't put pressure on either of them to try to be someone that they're not.
So, you know, from a psychological perspective, you kind of convey the impression that this is, to be completely objective, you know, possibly a useful alternative to monogamy, no worse, no better, trading in some stresses for other stresses. What about from an evolutionary perspective? I think many of us would assume that because of the prevalence of monogamy in human societies through time, that there's some evolutionary driving force towards that arrangement, but, you know, is this maybe telling us that things are not quite so simple?
Yeah, one of the evolutionary biologists I talked to is David Barish, who is the co-author of a book called The Myth of Monogamy, where he and Judith Lipton basically really debunked the whole idea that monogamy is the most natural state, and they looked at it in a variety of species, as well as humans. And sort of talked about the fact that actually, you know, in terms of evolutionary fitness, having multiple partners may be the best way to go because you get more variation and more ability to, you know, get the most possibilities to have strong offspring. But at the same time, I think from an evolutionary point of view, it's really hard to say whether polyamory or something like it makes us a fitter species. People have been identifying themselves as polyamorous for only a few decades. So it's very hard to say whether this is going to result in better child-rearing arrangements or stronger offspring when it's such a short-lived phenomenon in terms of the whole evolution of the human species. But it does seem clear that we do have a very, very strong drive to stray from monogamous relationships. And I think that drive, most evolutionary biologists would agree, is just as strong as the drive to remain faithful. So I think it'll be interesting to see how it pans out over the decades to come.
Well, thanks very much, Annalee. You've given us a great introduction into what I think is a poorly understood aspect of human behavior.
Okay, thank you very much.
Annalee Newitt spoke to us from her home in San Francisco. Her feature story about polyamory can be found in this week's issue of New Scientist magazine. Provided, of course, your significant others haven't made off with your copy.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
It may not strike you as very exotic, but graphite, the same stuff that makes up common pencil lead, is turning out to be one of the most exciting new materials in science today. Graphite is made up of layers of carbon atoms. What's new about it is that physicists have discovered they can isolate individual layers of graphite that are essentially two-dimensional, literally one atom thick. They've even given the stuff a different name, graphene, and for good reason, because when you can slice matter that thin, it can do things that no other material can.
Andre Geim is a physicist. But a better job description might be explorer. Once he's established himself along a line of research, his instinct is to head off in a completely different direction.
My personal style of doing physics, okay, it's a relatively unusual style. Most scientists these days stick to the subject they got from their PhD supervisor and often retire doing exactly the same physics. I try to switch, okay, or circumstances switch my interest every 5-7 years.
And all that switching has led Geim to make some novel discoveries. Although he was trained as a condensed matter physicist, he first made headlines in the 1990s by magnetically levitating a live frog. Then, in 2003, he and his team at the University of Manchester came up with an adhesive tape that works like a gecko's sticky feet. But no sooner was gecko tape a reality than Geim was off in a new direction, and his motivation was one of the most powerful you can find in science.
I believe it was spite.
And here's how spite can lead to great research. A few years ago, carbon nanotubes became all the rage in physics. These are carbon atoms arranged in tiny tube-like structures, and they have all sorts of interesting applications. Geim and his colleagues were watching these developments from the sidelines, and they wanted in.
Carbon nanotubes brought a lot of surprises, and this research has so much promise that we wanted to give it a go in slightly different direction, out of the crowd. We were not dealing with carbon nanotubes, so we wanted to enter this area from a different perspective.
In this case, the different perspective was to think flat. Geim and his team began to work with graphite, which is made up of thin, flat sheets of carbon. And that turned out to be a very good idea.
So what we wanted to do, to make graphite as thin as possible. We didn't expect that we will go to an individual sheet, but as we try to go to thinner and thinner dimensions, then we found out that we can reach a single sheet of graphene.
Now you may be wondering why graphene would qualify as an important breakthrough. To help explain that, Geim offers an analogy.
5 centuries ago, or something like that, we thought that the Earth was flat, and now we perfectly know that it's three-dimensional. So until, say, a couple of years ago, it was presumed that crystals and materials can exist only in three dimensions. We found out that, in fact, there are materials which are strictly two-dimensional, which consist only, which are only one atom thick.
According to conventional theory, whenever something is sliced very, very thinly, thermal vibrations at the atomic scale render it unstable. So it was expected that a sheet of carbon, one atom thick, would quickly disintegrate into clusters of soot particles. But that's not what happened, and now Geim has discovered a whole new dimension of material behavior.
When one finds a new class of materials, you immediately expect something new, which would be interesting for both applications and in terms of fundamental science. At the moment, we're just at the very early stages where we cannot even appreciate whether it would be a huge revolution or would it be just a blip on our scientific screens. I'm not saying that it revolutionizes our applications or our understanding of nature, but what is important is that it has a potential to do so.
and there are reasons to think that graphene could one day have a big impact on future technology. For starters, Geim found that it carries electricity, but not the way a typical conductor does. In graphene, the electrons that transport an electric current get an unusually smooth ride. Their motion is described as ballistic, and someday that could translate into much faster electronics.
In materials, electrons usually scatter on different impurities, or they scatter also on thermal excitation in the lattice. So they usually move only few atoms before being scattered at ambient conditions. In graphene, charge carriers, electrons, for instance, they move a huge distances, tens of thousands of interatomic lattices before being scattered. So this is important for possible applications because, say, ballistic transistor has been the holy grail for all electronic engineers because it would be probably ultimately quick transistor because everything could be determined by the speed with which electrons move from one point to another.
But while the promise of a faster graphene computer remains a far-off development, scientists are already waking up to the possibility of using graphene to study the laws of physics. That's because electrons move so easily in graphene, their speeds can approach the speed of light. In some cases, a small tabletop experiment can reveal more and different phenomena than a giant particle accelerator.
Graphene offers us a whole laboratory or a shooting range, if you wish, where we can test our ideas about the universe, about how particles behave when they're speeded to velocities close to the speed of light.
And the scientific potential of graphene extends to some of the most extreme and exotic environments in the universe. Environments that can never be studied close up, because they would literally destroy us.
One of the phenomena which is relevant to the physics which is in graphene occurs near the surface of neutron stars, okay? Huge densities of plasma, huge magnetic fields, and so on. And this phenomena, we can't recreate those conditions on the Earth, but we can mimic them in just a humble piece left by a pencil on the surface.
And if anyone is prepared to take the journey from pencil lead to neutron star, it's André Geim, the physicist who likes to stray off the beaten track. Even Geim admits the discovery of graphene is his most interesting diversion to date. The question now is whether this diversion is also a full-scale physics revolution. But even if it's not, it's likely to keep him busy enough to avoid the need for any more diversions anytime soon.
There is no boring moment for the moment, it's all highly, highly new, highly amazing, and requires a lot of, like a chess game, requires a lot of thinking to understand what graphene properties mean.
You can read more about André Geim's work with graphene in this week's edition of New Scientist. And right now, it's time for this week's research news.
Physicists from India and the Ukraine are proposing to launch an artificial solar system to test whether the universe has a hidden extra dimension. The idea stems from a theory that suggests gravity is much weaker than other forces in nature because a portion of its strength is leaking into other dimensions. Instead of a sun, the artificial solar system would feature a 5-kilogram tungsten ball orbited by a smaller mass at a distance of about 10 centimeters. Under the force of their mutual gravitation, the smaller mass should circle the larger ball approximately 8 times per day. The presence of an extra dimension would show up as an unexpected change in the trajectory of the smaller mass. The two masses would be in free fall, encased in a larger spacecraft that would shield them from external effects such as solar wind and cosmic rays. The entire experiment would be sent to the L2 point, about 1 million kilometers from Earth, where the gravity of Earth and Sun are essentially in balance. Loss of forest and wetland habitat is considered to be a major threat to frog and toad species around the world. But now a Canadian study has found that in rural North America, it's cars rather than chainsaws that pose the biggest threat of all. Biologists at Carleton University in Ottawa surveyed 38 ponds in the surrounding countryside. They estimated frog and toad numbers by visual searches in the day and by listening for calls at night. They also recorded the amount of intact forest and wetland within 2 kilometres of the ponds and the volume of road traffic in the area. They found that heavy traffic was bad news for amphibians, and for 5 out of 6 species it seemed to reduce populations even more than loss of habitat. The researchers recommend that major new roads should avoid areas with large frog and toad populations. They presented their findings last week at the Society for Conservation Biology meeting in San Jose, California. And finally, while cars may be bad news for frogs, corrosion is bad news for cars. And now it looks like those cars could last a whole lot longer, thanks to a smart coating that can stop rust in its tracks. Today, metals are protected from corrosion either by galvanizing them with a thin layer of zinc or by applying a waterproof polymer film. The problem is, the moment these coatings are punctured, water and air can penetrate and do their worst to the metal underneath. The smart new coating consists of minuscule silica balls embedded in a gel. When the coating is damaged, the silica balls break open, releasing the ingredients for an electrochemical reaction that inhibits rust and seals the breach. The coating was developed by German researchers who say the process could provide an alternative to chrome plating for cars. Chrome plating is associated with health risks and is currently being phased out of manufacturing in Europe.
We hope you're enjoying this week's episode of SciPod, and we really want to know what you think of our program. So if you've got a comment or question, please consider dropping us a line. It's easy, just send your message to podcast@newscientist.com, and thanks again for listening.
Now we dip into the last word column, the place where New Scientist readers pose their most intriguing science questions, and where other readers get the chance to have the last word on the answers. Over 100 of these questions and answers can be found in the best-selling book, Does Anything Eat Wasps? This week, Ivan explores another good question with Last Word editor, Mick O'Hare.
And once again, we welcome Mick O'Hare, production editor of New Scientist magazine. Mick, I know we're pulling you away from some important production editor work. You're looking at some rare forms of paper. I think it's Bolivian seaweed paper this week that you're... I'm contemplating printing the magazine on.
Exactly. It's very cheap.
Yes. Cheap but rugged. So you've been entrancing us with questions drawn from the Last Word column and also from the compilation in Does Anything Eat Wasps? Last week we were talking about why honey bends bread. What is this week's edifying question?
This week's edifying question is very short and sweet. It's why do people have eyebrows?
Oh, this is great. This is the kind of question where, you know, as you say, it's a short one to ask, but a subtle one and the kind of question that could invite multiple answers from our readers. So what is the last word on this? Why do we have eyebrows? Out of all the possible places where we could have hair on our face, why has hair remained at our eyebrows?
Well, as you said, we have multiple answers. We have two very good answers. The one I knew from school, and I always remember, it was to keep sweat out of your eyes. So when we were playing football, they were always told that, you know, that you can't shave those off, you've got to have them, otherwise you're not going to see the ball. And it's true. You do need eyebrows. A gentleman wrote to us whose father had alopecia and said that it was dreadful, the sweat running down to his eyes used to sting, something terrible. So you do need eyebrows to help keep the sweat out. But there's a second...
You know, I'm still getting my head around the fact that at your school they had to tell you not to shave your eyebrows.
Actually, I was embellishing the story a little bit, but it did work all the same.
Yes. No, and it makes sense, of course. Without those eyebrows, the sweat runs. And as you say, we have firsthand experience with that.
Stinging eyes.
Yeah, but there was a second reason to this.
We hadn't contemplated there was anything else, but there was. It was, and it's even more interesting than the sweaty thing. Eyebrows are a good indicator of your mood. So you lift an eyebrow for surprise or you pull them together when you're frowning. And people who have no eyebrows or have had Botox injections in that part of their face and can't move their eyebrows can't convey their emotions as well as people with eyebrows.
Right, so this kind of points to an evolutionary answer where the ability to convey expression and to convey emotion could be useful, quite useful.
It certainly would.
And I guess the it's a kind of an action at a distance, isn't it? Because the thing that you get from eyebrows is being able to communicate emotions over, you know, many feet.
Exactly, you don't even need to speak.
And so, you know, imagining our primate ancestors walking through, walking across the savannah, encountering a stranger, you know, before they're within reach, or before they're close enough to do damage, you can actually read their expression and use the eyebrows.
Especially if they're starting to frown and look angry. Exactly. You can tell open face or an angry face just from the eyebrows.
This actually comes up when you're drawing, you know, when you just try and do little cartoons. If you draw a circle and put in a couple of eyes and a nose, that is a completely neutral face, but the minute you add eyebrows, just two squiggly little lines, it's astounding how much expression,
exactly,
how much emotional content.
You can convey surprise very easily in that way.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense that, you know, as that it makes perfect sense that evolution would seize upon these linear features, because, you know, with eyes, what can you do except close them, right? They're just on or off. But with a linear feature like an eyebrow, you can twist it all kinds of ways and get across.
And what's also interesting is that probably evolved afterwards. The eyebrows probably did evolve first to keep out the sweat, and secondly, they have this secondary use.
Yeah, exactly. So that it's unlikely. I think that's a perfect illustration. Of course, we're speculating here because, you know, no one was there to see this evolutionary process in action. But it's plausible. It seems to fit with what evolutionary biologists say, which is that evolution kind of makes use of what's at hand.
Exactly.
So, well, you wouldn't believe what my eyebrows are doing right now. They're just, you know...
And I shaved mine off, of course.
Exactly. They're arched with amazement. Once again, Mick, thank you very much for joining us and for your contribution to The Last Word.
Thanks, Evan.
For this episode of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you'll find in the July the 8th issue of New Scientist magazine. Also this week, the mother of all construction projects. Japanese researchers discover how to use a particle accelerator to build a whole new universe.
The secret life of the comatose brain. After 18 years, a patient's dramatic recovery shifts perceptions about how much is really going on inside.
And fast forward. A device which scans video footage at high speed could help analysts monitor large volumes of data.
This edition of SciPod was brought to you by the staff and contributors of New Scientist magazine and NewScientist.com, which this week included Claire Bowles, Rowan Hooper, Greg Wong, and Valerie Jameson. Our technical production is by Bill Oxley, and our theme music was created and performed by the Damn Neighbors.
John McFarlane is the executive producer of SciPod. I'm Caroline Williams.
And I'm Ivan Semenek. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.